This is Harry Marble with today's feature story. On every weekday at this time, we bring you a newsreel of events here and abroad. With the help of our CBS correspondents, we try to tell you what the people of the world are doing and thinking in this most exciting moment of history. Today, we're going to focus our attention on the forthcoming United Nations conference at San Francisco. From Washington and the scene itself, San Francisco, we'll hear that getting ready for a world-shaking meeting can be quite a headache. That is, it can be if you're the one who is aware that even diplomats have to eat, sleep, and be entertained. In less than a month now, San Francisco, crowded already, will have to clear the way for from 2,000 to 3,000 visitors. It will be a pleasure, of course, in a way. But it's also apt to present quite a few problems when the visitors stay 6 weeks or more. In Washington, CBS correspondent Chris Coffin has been talking to State Department officials about the practical side of this conference. So for his report, we take you now to Washington.
There was a time when the atmosphere at the State Department reminded you of an etching of people dancing the minuet, gray and sedate. But that's no more. Secretary of State Stettinius and the Big Three are equally to blame for blowing out this unruffled, unhurried calm. Mr. Stettinius painted the walls green, opened the windows, and hired some new people. The Big Three decided to hold a United Nations conference at San Francisco on April 25th, and casually turned over to the State Department the job of arrangements. Today, men who were once a model of dignity and decorum wear the same harassed look as the white rabbit in Alice in Wonderland. Frankly, I would too, under the circumstances. Where, for example, can one find scores of Russian, French, and Spanish typewriters in a moment's notice? You can't get them from a mail-order catalog or pick them up at Woolworth's, but somewhere these typewriters must be found. The fate of the world is tied up in such small details. I called up one State Department official who has been there a long time and usually knows the answers. I told him I'd like to know something about the arrangements. He said in a despairing voice, "I feel rather low. The hotels are crowded. There are 43 delegations and we don't know how large they are or who is coming. We don't know how many single or double rooms to order. We don't know when the trains to San Francisco will run. And the railroads say they can't tell us until we advise them how many people to accommodate and when." I asked him gingerly, "Who is running the conference?" I distinctly heard a low groan as he replied, "I'd like to find that out myself." Then I asked if I could come over and talk to him some more about the arrangements. He answered, "I'm too busy to talk. I'm trying to find out something about the conference myself. I guess I'll have to go to San Francisco." And he did. By working through the underground, I did find out who is in charge of arrangements. He is an up-and-coming young official, Alger Hiss, Deputy Director of the Office of Special Political Affairs. He was one of the three men to accompany Secretary Stettinius to Yalta, and he was secretary of the Dumbarton Oaks meeting. Four secretaries and his outer office are busy hammering away at typewriters and answering phones. The office looks out on the White House and a beautiful magnolia tree, but the girls are too busy to appreciate the scenery. Mr. Hiss is hardly ever in his office, and I suspect it is for his own protection. His assistant, James F. Green, is a singularly unflustered and efficient young man. He says everyone wants to go to San Francisco, from the CIO to the ladies' sewing circle. Hotel space is a glorious headache, and the State Department is figuring on an attendance of from 2,000 to 3,000 persons for from 6 to 8 weeks. Communications are another problem. Not only must there be straight wires for ordinary communications, but each delegation has to have special code wires and transmitters for sending secret messages to the home governments. And what do you do about languages at a world conference? There are four sponsoring nations, the United States, Britain, Russia, and China. So there will be at least three official languages. This means a triple mimeograph job for all official documents. There is a shortage of good interpreters. So the State Department is scouring the country for people who can speak and read Russian, Chinese, Arabic, or what have you. Interpreters are not the only language worry. How would you like the job of finding telephone operators who can speak Portuguese and Russian? I wouldn't. The delegates must be protected from curious crowds, from cranks with pet projects for saving the world, from characters with pistols, and in some cases, from the prying news hawks. All work and no play would make Jack Delegate a dull boy. At the moment, Los Angeles is trying to convince the State Department it can keep the conferees deliriously happy in their spare time. No reflections on San Francisco, of course. I return you to CBS in New York.
Chris Coffin has been reporting on a part of the San Francisco conference, that part that worries the practical minds of the State Department getting ready for it. In San Francisco, the problems are accompanied by an uncomfortable reality. That's where they all have to be resolved. CBS reporter Don Mosley has been looking into the situation, and he says progress is being made. For more of his report, we take you now to San Francisco.
When San Francisco was chosen as the United Nations meeting place, the page of the dictionary that carried the word capacity wrinkled up in shame. For generous as San Francisco always has been, it could not give up something it didn't have, and that was space. At least that was the obvious situation some weeks ago, and yet today it's beginning to look as though the 2,000 delegates may all be able to sleep the same night. The situation was simply this. As the key port servicing the Pacific War, San Francisco has grown in population and activity, but not so much in housing. As a result, hotels are jammed with permanent residents, and transients may stay just 5 days for fear that they too may roost forever. About 400 families a day advertise in the newspapers for a place to stay, and this usually brings no results at all. In fact, the whole dilemma was concisely put by the Baron Jacques Bayon, the newly appointed Consul General of France. "It's marvelous," he said, "but what about housing? Oh my, what about housing?" The first day that San Francisco learned it would be host to the worldwide conference, every hotel in town was besieged with calls for space. But luckily, Mayor Lapham and his tourist convention head, Walter Swanson, got to the bewildered hotel managers first and pledged them all to take no reservations after April 20th. This probably saved the sightseer problem, since there will be room for none, but would the vacated space be enough for the delegates? And what about the remaining couple thousand assistants, world press and radio people, and the man who is bringing the crown jewels? Or did I mention him? Well, he comes from that group of nomadic citizenry who for a time hoped the conference would be some sort of diplomatic carnival, and he begged for a concession to exhibit replicas of the British crown jewels. So far, we understand, he has made no headway at all, and the jewels will be lucky if they get a spot over in Oakland. Surprisingly enough, Mayor Lapham's Committee on Rooms has had very little trouble from out-of-town tourists, and it seems that most people realize it would be impossible to accommodate them and haven't even bothered to inquire. Perhaps more trouble than help are the thousands upon thousands of offers from public-spirited people who have special services to volunteer. Two have been accepted that we know about. The Chrysler Corporation is sending the mayor a bulletproof car for his guests, and the Remington typewriter people have found some machines that print in Russian. The Chinese delegates will depend on Chinatown for theirs and should have virtually no trouble. Incidentally, the armored car is not an indication that trouble is expected, but everyone in town wants to be on the ultra-safe side. A quiet cleanup of confidence men, imposters, and others of that stripe is underway, but the FBI, State Department security officers, and police department are working slowly in the belief that a sudden crackdown would focus undesirable attention on the city. Getting back to the unsolved needs, however, what San Francisco wants rather desperately is a restaurateur who can move himself and staff into one of the conference buildings. Neither the Opera House nor Veterans Building has adequate serving facilities, and there's not a large cafe in that part of town. The poor old telephone company is working overtime on two main problems. One is to handle regular calls in French, Russian, Spanish, and Portuguese, and the other is to install a system for the delegates so they can hear speeches read by interpreters in their own language, as the address is given from the floor in English. San Francisco's Chinatown already has its own telephone exchange, and such matters will be routine for it. One thing that does seem to fit the needs of everyone is the site of the meetings themselves, the beautiful Veterans Building and the Opera House. There are more than 15 conference rooms available and plenty of auditorium space. And the green and ivory reading room of the Veterans Building is one of the most beautiful rooms in the West. Yes, this will be a gargantuan job for San Francisco, one that will require great effort and resource. But you can take the word of Mayor Lapham, this is the city that can do it. I return you now to CBS in New York.
Don Mosley has been telling us what has to be done when the family of nations comes to call. He and Chris Coffin in Washington have told us about the preliminaries of a meeting as large as the one which San Francisco will see next month. Next, we're going to hear from a city which hopes to be a part of what comes afterward. Philadelphia has put in a bid to be the permanent home of the United Nations Council. For more of that story, we take you now to Philadelphia.
We present now the Honorable Bernard Samuel, Mayor of Philadelphia. Mayor Samuel.
Philadelphia is the spiritual world capital of liberty and freedom. As mayor of this great city, it is both my duty and privilege to offer the city of brotherly love as permanent headquarters for the United Nations Council. I have also suggested that the peace treaty should be written and signed in America's most sacred shrine, Independence Hall. We have here the most beautiful and significant public building in all the world, Independence Hall, from whose steps was proclaimed the Declaration of Independence and in whose hallowed halls was formulated our great Constitution. There are a number of buildings in the group comprising Independence Hall. They were made a national shrine by an agreement signed by the city of Philadelphia and the federal government. This step was taken to clear the way for government aid in improving Independence Hall to make it a national park. It is proposed to enlarge the park around this historic shrine, to give a dignified setting for the buildings which would house the offices of the United Nations Council. It is most appropriate that those responsible for maintaining world peace should waver in the shadow of the birthplace of political ideals for which we are fighting in this great world war. But Philadelphia has other claims. Its very name, meaning the city of brotherly love, is an inspiration in itself. Its founder, William Penn, one of the pioneers of World Organization for Peace, dedicated this city to that idea. Here in Independence Hall is the home of the Liberty Bell, which bears the inscription, "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof." Independence Hall was formally thrown open as a national museum July the 4th, 1876. The collection consists of furniture, manuscripts, musical instruments, art, and books. There are many historic oil portraits in the National Portrait Gallery in Independence Hall, including Washington, another early American public man. It has been proposed that the United Nations Assembly, made up of representatives from all the nations, rotate its yearly meetings among the capitals of the world. But the Council of 11 members, the executive committee of this World Organization for Peace, must have some permanent headquarters for its secretaries and records. In San Francisco, conference must make that choice. Naturally, there will be some pulling and hauling. We Philadelphians contend that there is no other spot on earth which would be so widely recognized and so readily accepted by men of goodwill throughout the world as Independence Hall in the city of brotherly love. If I had the time, I would tell you of the beauty of this city, of all of its historic buildings, of its fine parks, excellent hotels, and transportation system. The United Nations Council would be very welcome here, and they would find the accommodations very pleasant. Philadelphia is a city of peace, and it would be the ideal city of the world for the emissaries of the universe to meet and provide for a permanent peace. All roads lead to Rome, applied when men were earthbound. Today, all airways lead equally to any spot on the globe where there are adequate airfields and seaplane bases. Philadelphia pledges to supply all the facilities if the United Nations chooses to accept its hospitality and share in its inspiring heritage. Let us hope that all the citizens of America will join us in extending to the United Nations Council an urgent appeal to make the city of Philadelphia its permanent home for the good of all mankind.
You just heard Mayor Bernard Samuel of Philadelphia speaking to you from the studios of WCAU. We return you now to CBS in New York.
And that was today's feature story, brought to you Monday through Friday at this same time. Tomorrow, this program will originate in Carnegie Hall, where the Army Navy E will be given to the Born Workshop, part of the New York Association for the Blind. Until then, this is Harry Marble speaking. This is CBS, the Columbia...